Good evening. My name's Tim Besley. I'm Professor of Economics here at the LSE and Director of the Suntory Toyota Centers for Economics and Related Disciplines, or STICCERD as it's known for short. It's a privilege to welcome Ben Bernanke, a member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, to give a lecture on monetary policy and financial markets. I should say that this lecture is co-sponsored by STICCERD, the Bank of England, and the Department of Economics at the LSE. Governor Bernanke personifies a tradition that we value here at the LSE, combining distinction in academic and in public life. I'm pleased in this context to welcome Charlie Bean, now Chief Economist of the Bank of England and a former economics professor at the LSE, back here, and to express our gratitude to him for co-sponsoring this lecture. The LSE greatly values our strong links with the Bank of England, which occur at a number of levels. Our lecturer this evening is extremely distinguished. Prior to taking up his present position in August 2002, Governor Bernanke was Howard Harrison and Gabrielle Snyder Beck Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton. He holds a BA degree in economics from Harvard and a PhD in economics from MIT. Governor Bernanke taught at Princeton from 1985, having previously taught at Stanford. Among his achievements at Princeton, Ben was a highly successful chair in the Department of Economics. As an academic, he's made many important contributions. Of particular note in the context of today's lecture is his seminal work with Mark Gertler, linking microeconomic agency problems in financial markets with macroeconomic phenomena. However, he's contributed to a wide variety of important issues in macroeconomics and monetary economics. Governor Bernanke has received many honors, among them a fellowship of the Econometric Society of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he's currently editor of the American Economic Review. On a personal note, it gives me enormous pleasure to welcome you here, Ben. We've known each other for a number of years, having been colleagues at Princeton before I came here to the LSE. We've also in recent times shared the dubious pleasure of editorial responsibilities at the AER. We look very much to hearing what you have to say. Ben will speak for a while, and then at the end of that, there will be plenty of opportunity for questions. And for members of the press, we will hold a separate session at the conclusion of the questions from the floor, where you have specific other issues to take up with Ben. In the meantime, I should say, Ben, we look very much forward to hearing what you have to say on this interesting and important topic. Thank you very much.
Very nice to be back to here at the LSE and to see Tim again. He was my colleague. We were squash partners. I miss him on that respect, certainly, in any other, no respect otherwise. we tried to get Tim to come back to Princeton. We're unfortunately for us unsuccessful. What I'll do today is talk for a bit. The exact title of my speech is Monetary Policy in the Stock Market, and it's some empirical results. It's based, as I'll say, on some research that I've been doing with colleagues at the Federal Reserve. But I hope to leave plenty of time for general questions, either on the topic of the talk, and within reason, knowing that as a policymaker, no comment is always a possible response, on other topics relating to the U.S. economy or whatever you're interested in knowing about. The ultimate objective of monetary policymakers is to promote both the health of the U.S. economy, which we do by pursuing our mandated goals of price stability and maximum sustainable output and employment. However, the effects of our policy instruments, such as the short-term interest rate, on these goal variables are indirect at best. Instead, monetary policy actions have their most direct and immediate effects on the broader financial markets, including the stock market, government and corporate bond markets, mortgage markets, markets for consumer credit, foreign exchange markets, and many others. If all goes as planned, the changes in financial asset prices and returns induced by the actions of monetary policymakers lead to changes in economic behavior that policy was trying to achieve. Thus, understanding how monetary policy affects the broader economy necessarily entails understanding both how policy actions affect key financial markets as well as how changes in asset prices and returns in these markets in turn affect the behavior of households, firms, and other decision makers. Studying these links is an ongoing enterprise of monetary economists both within and outside the Federal Reserve System. The link between monetary policy and the stock market is of particular interest. Stock prices are among the most closely watched asset prices in the economy and are viewed as being highly sensitive to economic conditions. Stock prices have also been known to swing rather widely, leading to concerns about possible bubbles or other deviations of stock prices from fundamental values that may have adverse implications for the economy. It is of great interest, then, to understand more precisely how monetary policy and the stock market are related. In my talk today, I will report the results of research that I have done on this topic with Kenneth Kuttner of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, as well as the findings of some related work done both within and outside the Federal Reserve System. The underlying paper, by the way, is available at the New York Fed's website, research website. The views I will express today, however, are my own and not necessarily those of my colleagues on the Federal Open Market Committee or the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. In our research, Kuttner and I asked two questions. First, by how much do changes in monetary policy affect equity prices? As you will see, we focus on changes in monetary policy that are unanticipated by market participants, because anticipated changes in policy should already be discounted by stock market investors, and hence are unlikely to affect equity prices at the time at which they are announced. We find an effect of moderate size. Monetary policy matters for the stock market, but on the other hand, it is not one of the major influences on equity prices. Our second question, both more interesting and more difficult, is why do changes in monetary policy affect stock prices? We come up with a rather surprising answer, at least one that was surprising to us. We find that unanticipated changes in monetary policy affect stock prices not so much by influencing expected dividends or the risk-free interest rate, but rather by affecting the perceived riskiness of stocks. A tightening of monetary policy, for example, leads investors to view stocks as riskier investments and thus to demand a higher return to hold stocks. For a given path of expected dividends, a higher expected return can be achieved only by a fall in the current stock price. As we will see, this finding has interesting implications for several issues, including the role of stock prices in transmitting the effects of monetary policy actions to the broader economy, and the potential effectiveness of monetary policy in pricking putative bubbles in the stock market. I'll come back to these issues at the end of my talk. I start, however, with the problem of measuring the effect of monetary policy on the stock market. Normally, the Federal Open Market Committee, or FOMC, the monetary policy making arm of the Federal Reserve, announces its interest rate decisions at around 2:15 p.m. following each of its 8 regularly scheduled meetings each year. An air of expectation reigns in financial markets for the few minutes prior to the announcement. If you happen to have access to a monitor that tracks key market indexes, at 2:15 p.m. on an announcement day, you can watch those indexes quiver as if trying to digest the information in the rate decision and the FOMC's accompanying statement of explanation. Then the black line representing each market index moves quickly up or down, and the markets have priced the FOMC action into the aggregate values of U.S. equities, bonds, and other assets. On occasion, if economic conditions warrant, the FOMC may decide to make a change in monetary policy on a day that falls between the regularly scheduled meetings of the committee, a so-called intermeeting move. Intermeeting moves, typically agreed upon during a conference call of the committee, nearly always take financial markets by surprise, at least in their precise timing, and they are often followed by dramatic swings in asset prices. Even the casual observer, then, can have no doubt that FOMC decisions move asset prices, including equity prices. Estimating the size and duration of these effects, however, is not so straightforward, because traders in equity markets, as in most other financial markets, are generally highly informed and sophisticated, any policy decision that is largely anticipated will already be factored into stock prices and will elicit little reaction when announced. To measure the effects of monetary policy changes on the stock market, then, we need to have a measure of the portion of a given change in monetary policy that the market had not already anticipated before the FOMC's formal announcement. Fortunately, the financial markets themselves are a source of useful information about monetary policy expectations. As you may know, the FOMC implements its decisions about monetary policy by changing its target for a particular short-term interest rate called the federal funds rate. The federal funds rate is the rate at which depository institutions borrow and lend reserves to and from each other overnight. Although the Federal Reserve does not control the federal funds rate directly, it can do so indirectly by varying the supply of reserves available to be traded in this overnight market. So obviously analogous to the official rate that the Bank of England did not change today, I gather. Since October 1988, financial investors have been able to hedge and speculate on future values of the federal funds rate by trading contracts in a futures market overseen by the Chicago Board of Trade. Investors in this market have a strong financial incentive to try to guess correctly what the federal funds rate will be on average at various points in the future. The existence of a market in federal funds futures is a boon not only to investors, such as banks, which want to protect themselves against fluctuations in the cost of reserves, but also to both policymakers and researchers, because it allows any observer to infer from the sales prices of futures contracts the values of the federal funds rate that market participants anticipate at various future dates. Previous research, including some by my co-author, has shown that participants in this market collectively do a good job of forecasting future values of the funds rate, efficiently incorporating available information about likely future monetary policy actions. By using data from the federal funds futures market, then, it's possible to estimate the value at which financial markets participants expect the FOMC to set its target for the federal funds rate on any given date. By comparing this expected value to what the FOMC actually did at each date, we can determine the portion of the Fed's interest rate decision that came as a surprise to the financial markets. In our research, Kuttner and I considered all the dates of scheduled FOMC meetings, plus all the dates on which the FOMC changed the federal funds rate between meetings or made intermeeting moves, for the period May 1989 through December 2002, amounting to a total of 131 observations. For each of these dates, we used the expected value of the federal funds rate as inferred from the futures market to divide the actual change in the federal funds rate on that day into the part that was anticipated by the stock market and the part that was unanticipated. So, for example, last November 6, 2002, the Federal Reserve cut the federal funds rate by 50 basis points. A basis point equals 1/100th of a percentage point, and so 50 basis points equals half a percentage point. However, this cut in the federal funds rate was not entirely unanticipated. According to the federal funds futures market, investors were expecting a cut of about 31 basis points on average from the Fed at that meeting. So, of the 50 basis point cut that the FOMC lowered its target on last November 6th, only 19 basis points were a surprise to financial markets, and therefore only those 19 basis points should have been expected to affect asset prices. Note, by the way, that if the Fed had not changed interest rates at all that day, our method would have treated those actions as the equivalent of a surprise tightening of 31 basis points, because the Fed would have done nothing while the market was expecting an easing of 31 basis points. To evaluate the effect of monetary policy on the stock market, then, we looked at how broad measures of stock prices moved on the days in which the Fed made unanticipated changes to policy. I can illustrate our method by continuing the example of the Fed's rate cut last November the 6th. On that day, the broad stock market index we used in our study rose in value by 0.96 percentage points. Dividing the 96 basis point gain in the stock market by the 19 basis point downward surprise in the funds rate, we obtain a value of approximately 5 for what we can call the stock price multiplier, which relates policy changes to stock market changes. If this one day were representative, we could conclude that each basis point of surprise monetary easing leads to about a 5 basis point increase in the value of stocks. Or, choosing magnitudes that might be more helpful to the intuition, we could just as well say that a surprise cut of 25 basis points in the federal funds rate should lead the stock market to rise on the same day about 1.25 percentage points, or about 120 points in the Dow Jones Index at its current values. In fact, applying a formal regression analysis to the full sample from 1989 through 2002, we found a number pretty close to this one, a stock price multiplier for monetary policy of about 4.7. We also found, as expected, that changes in monetary policy that were anticipated by the market had small and statistically insignificant effects on stock prices, presumably because these anticipated changes were already priced into stocks. Although a stock price multiplier of about 5 for unanticipated changes in the federal funds rate is certainly not negligible, we should appreciate that unexpected changes in monetary policy account for a tiny portion of overall stock market volatility. Unanticipated movements in the federal funds rate of 20 basis points or more are relatively rare. We observed only 13 examples of that in our 14-year sample. Yet the change of 1% or so in the stock market induced by the typical 20 basis point surprise in the funds rate is swamped by the overall variability of stock prices. For example, over the past 5 years, the broad stock market has moved 1% or more on about 40% of all trading days, including today, by the way, where the stock market is up, at least last time I checked, about 1.5%. Thus, news about monetary policy contributes very little to the overall day-to-day fluctuations in stock prices. We explored our empirical results with some care. We noted, for example, that a few of the monetary policy changes in our sample were followed by what seemed to be excessive or otherwise unusual stock market responses. A number of these responses, interesting enough, occurred rather recently during the Fed's series of rate cuts in 2001. The Fed's surprise intermediate cuts of 50 basis points each on January 3rd and April 18th of 2001 were both greeted euphorically by the stock market, with one-day increases in stock values of 5.3% and 4.0% respectively. By contrast, the rate cut of 50 basis points on March 20th was received less enthusiastically. Even though the cut was more or less what the futures market had been anticipating, the financial press reported that many equity market participants were disappointed that the cut had not been an even more generous 75 basis points. So in any event, the stock market lost more than 2% on that day, despite the cut in policy. To ensure that our results did not depend on a few unusual observations or outliers, we reran our regressions, omitting the days with the most extreme or unusual market moves. This more conservative analysis led to a smaller estimate of the effect of policy actions on the stock market, a stock price multiplier of about 2.6 rather than 4.7. However, the effect remained quite significant in statistical terms. We considered a variety of other variations as well. For example, we investigated whether the magnitude of the effect on the stock market of a surprise policy tightening, that is, an increase in interest rates, differs from the effect of a surprise policy easing or a decrease in interest rates. And we found that it does not. It's a symmetrical effect. Yet another experiment consisted of asking whether an unanticipated policy change has a larger effect if it's thought by the market to signal a longer-lasting change in policy. We measured the perceived permanence of policy changes by observing the effects of unanticipated policy changes on the expected federal funds rate 3 months in the future, as measured by the futures market. The stock market multiplier associated with unanticipated policy moves that are perceived to be more permanent is a bit higher, as would be expected, and its value is about 6. In short, the statistical evidence is strong for a stock price multiplier of monetary policy of something between 3 and 6, the higher values corresponding to policy changes that investors perceive to be relatively more permanent. That is, according to our findings, a surprise easing by the Fed of 25 basis points will typically lead broad stock indices to rise from 0.75 percentage point to 1.5 percentage points. Incidentally, similar results obtained for stock values of industry groups. We find almost all industry stock portfolios respond significantly to changes in monetary policy, with telecommunications, high-tech, and durable goods industry stocks being the most sensitive to monetary policy news, and energy, utilities, and healthcare stocks being the least sensitive. These results can be broadly explained by the tendency of each industry to move along with the broad market, or to use the language of the standard capital asset pricing theory by the industry betas, those of you taking a little finance. It's interesting, though perhaps not terribly surprising, to know that the Federal Reserve policy actions can affect stock prices. An even more interesting question, though, is why does this effect occur? Answering this question will give us some insight into how monetary policy affects the economy, as well as into the role the stock market should play in making policy decisions. A share of stock is a claim on the current and future dividends or other cash flows, such as stock buybacks, to be paid by a company. Suppose for just a moment that financial investors don't care about risk. Then only two types of news ought to affect current stock values. News that affects investor expectations of current or future dividends after tax, or news that affects current forecast of current or future short-term interest rates. News that current or future dividends, which I want to think here is being measured in real or inflation-adjusted terms, news about dividends that is, says they're likely to be higher than previously expected, say because the company is expected to be more profitable, should raise the current stock price, while news that current or future short-term interest rates, which I'll also think of as being measured in real or inflation-adjusted terms, are likely to be higher than previously expected, should depress the stock price. There are two essentially equivalent ways of understanding why expectations of higher short-term real interest rates should lower stock prices. First, to value future dividends, an investor must discount them back to the present. As higher interest rates make a given future dividend less valuable in today's dollars, higher interest rates reduce the values of a share of stock. And second, higher real interest rates make investments that are alternatives to stocks, such as bonds, more attractive, raising the required return on stocks and reducing what investors are willing to pay for them. Under either interpretation, expectations of higher real interest rates are bad news for stocks. So, to reiterate, in a world in which investors do not care about risk, stock prices should change only with news about current or future dividends or news about current and future real interest rates. However, investors do care about risk, of course. Because investors care about risk and because stocks are perceived as relatively risky investments, investors generally demand a higher average return relative to other assets to hold stocks. Using long historical averages, one finds that in the United States, a diversified portfolio of stocks has paid between 5 and 6 percentage points more per year on average than a portfolio of government bonds. This extra return, known as the risk premium on stocks, or sometimes the equity premium, presumably reflects in part the extra compensation that investors demand to be willing to hold more, relatively more risky stocks. Like news about dividends and real interest rates, news that affects the risk premium on stocks also affects stock prices. For example, news of an impending recession could raise the risk premium on stocks in two ways. First, the macroeconomic environment is more volatile than usual during a recession, so stocks themselves may become riskier investments. Second, the income and wealth of financial investors tends to fall during a downturn, giving them a smaller cushion to support the lifestyles to which they are accustomed, to make house payments, for example. With less discretionary income and wealth available to absorb potential losses, people may become less willing to bear the risks of more volatile financial investments and therefore demand a higher return to do so. For both reasons, the extra return that investors demand to hold stocks is likely to rise when bad times loom. With expected dividends and the real interest rate on alternative assets held constant, the expected yield on stocks can rise only through a decline in the current stock price. We now have a list of three key factors that should affect stock prices. First, news that current or future dividends will be higher should raise stock prices. Second, news that current or future real short-term interest rates will be higher should lower stock prices. And third, news that leads investors to demand a higher risk premium on stocks should also lower stock prices. How does all this relate to the effects of monetary policy on stock prices? According to this analysis, which I've just gone through quite laboriously, Fed action should affect stock prices only to the extent they affect investor expectations about future dividends, short-term real interest rates, or the riskiness of stocks. The trick here is to determine quantitatively which of these sets of investor expectations is likely to be most affected when the Fed unexpectedly changes the federal funds rate. To make this determination, we used a methodology first applied by the financial economist John Campbell, who was also my colleague at Princeton when Tim was there, of Harvard University now, unfortunately, and by Campbell and John Ammer, the Federal Reserve Board staff. Putting the details aside, we can describe the Campbell-Ammer technology as follows. First, imagine that the expectations of stock market investors can be mimicked by a statistical forecasting model that takes relevant current data as inputs and projects estimated future values of aggregate dividends, real interest rates, and equity risk premiums as outputs. So we have this computer model, we put in the information, outcomes forecasts of dividends, interest rates, and riskiness, and from that, in principle, investors could use such a model to make a forecast of these variables and hence to estimate what they're willing to pay for stocks. Besides a number of standard variables that have been shown to be helpful in making forecasts of financial variables, suppose we include in the forecasting model our measure of the unanticipated change in the federal funds rate. So that's one of the information variables that goes into the machine that gives us the information about stocks at the end. That is, we use the information contained in these unanticipated changes in making our forecasts of future dividends, interest rates, and risk premium. Now we can consider the following thought experiment. Suppose we've run our computer model, made our forecasts, and inferred the appropriate values for stocks. But then we receive news that the Fed has unexpectedly raised the federal funds rate by 25 basis points. Based on our forecasting model, by how much would that information change our previous forecasts of future dividends, interest rates, and risk premium? The answer to this question clarifies the channel by which monetary policy affects stock prices. If we were to find, for example, that news of an unexpected increase in the federal funds rate significantly changes the forecast of future dividends, but doesn't much affect the forecast of the other two variables, Then we would conclude that monetary policy affects stock prices primarily by affecting investor expectations of future dividends. By contrast, if news of the policy action changed the model forecast for real interest rates, but did not change our forecast for the other two variables, we would decide that unanticipated policy actions affect stock prices primarily by influencing the interest rates expected by stock investors. What we actually found when we conducted this counterfactual statistical experiment was quite interesting. It appears that, for example, an unanticipated tightening of monetary policy leads to only a modest change in the optimal forecasts of future dividends, and to still less of a change in forecasts of future real interest rates beyond a few quarters. Quantitatively, according to our methodology, the most important effect of a policy tightening is on the forecasted risk premium. Specifically, an unanticipated tightening of monetary policy raises expected risk premium on stocks for a protracted period. For a given expected stream of dividend payouts and real interest rates, the risk premium, and hence the return to holding stocks, can rise only if the current stock price falls. So that explains why a tightening monetary policy lowers stock prices. So in short, to repeat, our analysis suggests that an unanticipated monetary tightening lowers stock prices only to a small extent by lowering investor expectations about future dividends, and by less still by raising expected real interest rate expectations. The most powerful effect of an unanticipated monetary tightening is to increase the perceived risk premium on stocks, either by increasing the riskiness of stocks themselves or by reducing the willingness of people to bear the risk inherent in stocks, or both. Reduced willingness of investors to hold relatively more risky stocks then in turn drives down stock prices. Our analysis does not explain precisely how monetary policy affects risk, but we can make some reasonable conjectures. For example, tighter monetary policy may raise the riskiness of shares themselves by raising interest costs and weakening the balance sheets of publicly owned firms. We've analyzed this in previous work. In the macroeconomy more generally, by reducing spending and economic activity, tighter money raises the risks of unemployment and bankruptcy faced by individual households and firms. In each case, tighter monetary policy increases risk by reducing financial buffers or otherwise increasing the vulnerability of individuals or firms to future shocks to the economy. So far, I've discussed two principal conclusions from the empirical analysis. First, the stock price multiplier of monetary policy is between 3 and 6. In other words, an unexpected change in the federal funds rate of 25 basis points leads, on average, to a movement of stock prices in the opposite direction of between 3/4 percentage points and 1.5 percentage points. Second, the main reason that unanticipated changes in monetary policy affect stock prices is that they affect the risk premium on stocks. In particular, a surprise tightening of policy raises the risk premium, lowering current stock prices, and a surprise easing of policy lowers the risk premium, raising current stock prices. What implications do these results have for our broader understanding and for the practice of monetary policy? I'll briefly discuss two issues. First, the role of the stock market in the transmission of monetary policy changes to the broader economy, and second, the efficacy of monetary policy as a tool for controlling stock market bubbles. A long-held element of the conventional wisdom is that stock market is an important part of the transmission mechanism for monetary policy. The logic goes as follows. Easier monetary policy, for example, raises asset prices. Higher stock prices increase the wealth of households, prompting consumers to spend more, a result known as the wealth effect. Moreover, high stock prices effectively reduce the cost of capital for firms, thereby stimulating capital investment. Increases in both types of spending, consumer spending and business spending, tend to stimulate the economy. This simple story can be elaborated somewhat in light of our results. It's true, as I've discussed, that an easier monetary policy raises stock prices, whereas a tighter monetary policy lowers them. However, easier monetary policy not only raises stock prices, as we have seen, it also lowers risk premia, presumably reflecting both a reduction in economic and financial volatility and an increase in the capacity of financial investors to bear risk. Thus, our results suggest that easier monetary policy not only allows consumers to enjoy a capital gain in their portfolios today, but it also reduces the effective amounts of economic and financial risk that they must face. This reduction in risk may cause consumers to trim their precautionary saving, that is, to reduce the amount of income they must put aside to protect themselves against unforeseen contingencies. Reduced precautionary saving, in turn, implies more spending by households. Thus, the reduction in risk associated with an easing of monetary policy and the resulting reduction in precautionary saving may amplify the short-run impact of policy operating through the traditional channel based on increased asset values, the wealth effect. Likewise, reduced risk and volatility may provide an extra kick to capital expenditure in the short run as well, as firms are more likely to undertake investments in new structures or equipment in a more stable and less risky macroeconomic environment. A second issue to which we can apply this results concerns the role of monetary policy in the management of large swings in stock values, so-called bubbles. In an earlier speech, it's on the Federal Reserve website, I gave a number of reasons why I believe that using monetary policy as opposed to microeconomic or prudential policies is not a good way to address the problem of asset market bubbles. These difficulties include the problems of identifying bubbles in advance, the questionable wisdom in the context of a free market economy of setting up the central bank as the arbiter of stock market values, the problem that arises when a bubble occurs in only one asset class rather than in all asset classes, and other reasons as well. A major concern that I have about the bubble popping strategy, however, is that attempts to bring down stock values by a significant amount using monetary policy are likely to have highly deleterious and unwanted side effects on the broader economy. The research I've described today allows me to address this issue more concretely. Here I'll make just 2 points. First, the research I've been describing suggests that relatively small changes in monetary policy would not do much to curb a major overvaluation in the stock market. As we have seen, a surprise tightening of 25 basis points should be expected to lower stock prices by only a little more than 1%, which, as already noted, is a trivial movement relative to the overall variability of the stock market. It would not be appropriate to extrapolate these results to estimate how much tightening would be needed to correct a substantial putative overvaluation in stock prices, but it seems clear that a light tapping on the brakes will not be a sufficient policy. What we can say is that the necessary policy move would have to be quite large, many percentage points on the federal funds rate, and we would be highly uncertain about its magnitude or its ultimate effects on the stock prices or on the economy. Second, we have seen that monetary tightening reduces stock prices primarily by increasing the risk premium for holding stocks, as opposed to raising the real interest rate or lowering expected dividends. The risk premium for stocks will rise only to the extent that broad macroeconomic risk rises, or that people experience declines in income and wealth that reduce their ability to absorb risk. This evidence supports the proposition that monetary policy can lower stock values only to the extent that it weakens the broader economy, and in particular that it makes households considerably worse off. Indeed, according to our analysis, policy would have to weaken the general economy quite significantly to obtain a large decline in stock prices. I've reported today on empirical work by my co-author and me, as well as by others, about the links between monetary policy and the stock market. I've only touched on a large literature, and I apologize to the many researchers whose work I've not been able to describe. There's really quite a large literature, many of it cited in the bibliography of the talk. People who worked in this general area, the empirical results in terms of the monetary policy multiplier are generally similar. Though I haven't described all this research, I hope I have given you a flavor of how empirical research can be used to help refine our understanding of how monetary policy works and of how policy can be conducted. Thanks. I'll stop now and turn back to Tim.
Thank you very much, Ben. As I said earlier, Ben is very happy to take questions from the floor at this point. Could I ask those of you who ask questions, though, to keep them brief, please?
You'll conduct your own.
Are there any questions? Yes.
You mentioned overvaluation of the stock market, which brings forward a rather interesting question. What is an appropriate value for the market? Is there such a thing? And the technical implication for policymakers such as yourself is, when do you know the market is overvalued? I mean, is there a number, a P/E ratio that you attach to the S&P? Or is it, well, if you look at the older books and you know, we talk about 8 to 12% 8 to 12 market multiple as being appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're talking about maybe 12 to 18 is appropriate. So there seems to be a moving goalpost over time. But as market maker as a policy makers such as yourself, I mean, what do you rely on?
Well, to answer the broader context here, to answer the question, one can make assessments based on such things as interest rates, differentials between interest rates and stock returns, forecasts of earnings and things of that sort. But the broader issue is really exactly what business does a central bank have trying to assess these valuations other than for its own information. I was responding in my talk, and I do so much more detail in my talk from last October, to a view that is fairly widely held, including in this country. I know one of your most popular magazines discusses it quite often, that central banks, that part of central banking is to identify misvaluations in asset prices, such as the stock market boom in the United States in the 1990s, for example, and that part of good central banking is to identify those misvaluations and then to use interest rate policy to try to bring them down and try to eliminate these, quote, bubbles. My view is very sympathetic to the one that you're expressing. I think, first of all, that it's extremely difficult, if possible at all, for the central bank to make any kind of realistic evaluation of whether or not an increase in stock prices is due to fundamental factors or to non-fundamental factors. And beyond that, as I've talked about today, it's also extremely difficult to use interest rate policy to affect stock prices. What I have argued, and I argue in this other speech in some detail, is that the right approach to dealing with asset market imbalances is to use prudential policies, of which there are two kinds. First, microeconomic prudential policies, making sure that banks and other institutions aren't lending based on bad collateral or based on improper, unsafe ratios, for example, which tends to blow up asset values. And secondly, using the central bank's lender of last resort function to deal with any kinds of problems that might arise in financial markets following a major fluctuation in stock prices, to make sure, for example, that the plumbing, the infrastructure of the financial market is working properly. So my view in brief is that monetary policy should focus primarily on the economy, the broad economy, inflation, output, unemployment, and those issues, and that it should not actively try to manage stock values. And I was responding to this view that perhaps we should try to manage stock values, and which I think I agree with your implicit premise that it's neither possible nor desirable to do so. Well, just anyway, that's my answer. Other question? Upstairs, anyone? Yes. With the microphone.
Thank you. My name is Simon Cox from one of these countries' more popular magazines. I wondered if your estimates of the multiplier are vulnerable to what you might call a Lucas critique. That is, they're small at the moment because no one thinks Greenspan is targeting asset prices, or at least not directly.
Mm-hmm.
If it were to be believed that he was, presumably those multipliers would grow very large.
No, I don't think it's subject to Lucas critique at all, because these examples were drawn specifically in the period in which this policy was advocated. Therefore, the movements in interest rates that we saw should have been interpreted as being attempts to move asset prices. What the Federal Reserve was trying to do, by the way, is quite contentious, as you know, and I won't get into that debate. I think the basic lesson here is that one of the definitions of an asset bubble in general, for example, according to Bob Shiller's book on irrational exuberance, is a situation in which people expect very high persistent returns on stock prices or any other asset. So, for example, during the 90s, people who were surveyed sometimes said they expected ongoing returns in the stock market of 12 or 15% indefinitely. If people have those kinds of expectations underlying a bubble, then the federal funds rate being moved 25 basis points is not going to make it less desirable to hold stocks, because it simply doesn't affect the net return on holding stocks. The only way that the Federal Reserve or any other central bank could credibly convince potential shareholders that holding stocks is a bad idea is by basically convincing shareholders that the Fed was going to bring down the whole economy if necessary in order to make stocks unprofitable.
But it wouldn't actually have to do that.
Well, the best way to do it would be to raise interest rates by many percentage points and see the effect. I think the only plausible way would be to convince the public, and the Lucas critique would tell you, irrational expectations would tell you that if you're not willing to bring the economy down, then it won't be a credible threat. So no, I don't think the Lucas critique is relevant to this. Yes.
Thank you, Governor. But initially, I thought the new Governor Arne is going to give us lectures. There are so many crowd outside, a lot of press, but it's nice that you're from a Federal Reserve Governor. Yeah, I got two issues for you. Number one is about I'm not an economist, so I can't talk about policy or financial market, ordinary man. Yep. About the economics of the recent wars and the policy of reconstruction. Is it a burden to your reserve, or ultimately you think that you'll reap the reward of all this adventure or misadventures? Number two is, what is your opinion about the British economy? Here, people are portraying. Your opinion about the British economy. Here, everybody thinks that the Chancellor has got more muscle than Arne. So ultimately, will he be a good premier? It's better to have a premier with a financial background. You have an MBA graduate in White House, and we got a barrister. So if the current Chancellor, will he become a premier? Will it be good for your foreign policy or the financial market for the whole world? Thank you.
I'm not qualified to make comments on foreign policy decisions. The most direct analysis is that naturally in the case of the United States is that there has been direct budgetary implications of the war and the reconstruction. And those have raised the U.S. budget deficit this year and next year and perhaps in the future. That is probably, in the short run, not a bad thing for the U.S. economy, because the increased aggregate demand generated by the greater deficit is probably useful at this point, given that we have a slowly recovering economy from the recession. In the long run, particularly as we have demographic changes which require pension spending and medical spending and so on, it'll be very important for the federal government to get its deficit under control. So from a policy perspective, the most important issue is really the fiscal implication. The fiscal implication has been expansionary in the short run. In the long run, it'll be important that it not be a perpetual drain on the U.S. budget, and that, you know, that be reconciled with the need to meet longer-term Social Security and Medicare expenditures.
Earlier in your talk, you spoke about financial markets being very sophisticated.
Yes.
And then while answering a question, you said stock market participants expected real returns of 15%. Which view do you actually hold, and to what extent does that undermine your results?
I think that's a very good question. There certainly are unsophisticated. If use the financial lingo, there's this thing, idea of noise traders. There's certainly people in the market who are not sophisticated or efficient and who drive prices sometimes more than they should be driven. But the great bulk of stock market traders, the great bulk of financial market traders are institutions or professional traders who are highly sophisticated in their assessments. And in any case, they are certainly as sophisticated as would be the Federal Open Market Committee in determining the fundamental value of stocks, for example. So my answer is both, that the bulk of the trading is done by sophisticated investors, but even sophisticated investors during periods of high volatility, their decision-making can be affected on the margin by the fact that you have these noise traders, these irrational traders in the market. So that does create additional volatility in the market. I certainly accept that point. But in the same way that it's not possible for the sophisticated traders to arbitrage away all of these deviations, it's also very difficult for the Federal Reserve to find those deviations. We have a mic down here? Yes, there.
You explained the effect of interest rates on the stock market through the equity risk premium. But even in your case, the effects were small. I was wondering if you thought your light shed more, if your analysis shed a light on the more general puzzle, what determines the equity risk premium? That 6% is still largely unexplained.
Well, the question is what determines the overall equity risk premium. I think the best explanation that we have currently, there is no complete explanation that explains all dimensions of asset market puzzles. Of course, you know there are many of them. But quantitatively, the models that seem to work best currently are the so-called habit formation models. And I cite in my paper the Cochrane and Campbell paper in the JPE from 1999. But there's been a series of papers which argue essentially that people get used to a level of consumption which they've been experiencing in a previous period of time, and that threats to that level of consumption become very costly to people. And that would help explain, if people are afraid to go below their customary level of consumption, that would explain why people act so in such a risk-averse manner towards holding highly volatile stocks in the short run. So that theory, I think, is a leading candidate to explain the risk premium. And it's entirely consistent with the view that I was been expositing for the monetary policy effect, the idea being that in a recession, people are pushed closer to the line, so to speak. People are at greater risk of having to cut their consumption below their customary levels. As a result, they act as if they are very risk averse. And that would help explain why the risk premium is as large as it is. In fact, why monetary policy has a big effect on the risk premium as it does. So it is consistent with, I think, the best theory of the equity premium that we have currently.
My name is John Greenwood. Your account today basically described the instantaneous effects of monetary policy changes on the stock market. But if there is no interest rate change over an extended period of time, as there has been recently, I'm sure you wouldn't say there hasn't been any monetary policy. So. Could you say a word or two about your research or your knowledge of the impact of the continuing impacts of monetary policy when there isn't an interest rate change? I mean, whether it's through reserves or bank behavior or through the capital markets more generally.
Well, we measure monetary policy changes by changes in the federal funds rate. That's the most obvious effect. And it affects interest rates in the market. To the extent, as we found in our paper, to the extent that the change in the federal funds rate is persistent and therefore more likely to affect longer term rates, it's going to have a larger effect on the stock market. We did not look at non-interest rate policies. The Fed, in fact, does not use other policies currently. But one could imagine looking at things like changes in reserve requirements or open market operations and trying to see what effects it might have, but we didn't do that. Again, the most direct way in which the Fed, just like the Bank of England, changes policies by changing the official interest rate, and that's what we examined. Over here somewhere?
Given that the central bank should not be adjusting... I'm loud. Given that the central bank should not be adjusting policy to burst a bubble, is it then reasonable to assume that, given the lags of monetary policy, once it's identified that there is a bubble, that perhaps, the correct response is to cut interest rates? Or is it to leave interest rates unchanged? Is it clear which way, or if anything should be done at all, once it's identified?
There are wheels within wheels in that question. Generally speaking, what I've argued in published research has been that the best way to deal with an asset market fluctuation, you don't know whether it's a bubble or not, and that's part of the issue, but let's say there's a big stock market boom, which you can't observe. The best way to deal with that is to ask yourself, what is the likely effect of the stock market boom on the general economy? For example, a stock market boom might be expansionary because it might cause consumers to feel wealthier and to spend more. It might cause firms to invest more. If that generates excess aggregate demand, then the appropriate response is to lean against that in order to avoid the inflationary or over-employment type consequences. So generally speaking, the policy which seems to work the best is one which focuses not on trying to control the stock price, but rather by taking what the stock market is doing more or less as given and then thinking about the implications for the economy both in the short run and the long run. Now, given the lags, and you're absolutely right, one could talk about different responses. I laughed because the gentleman from the famous magazine upstairs may be aware that there is a paper by Michael Bordeaux and Olivier Jean, which has been cited by that magazine as evidence that we should be pricking stock market bubbles, which looks at the case of where suppose the central bank has got
non-quadratic risk preferences. It's got a very broad set of risk preferences that allows for all different outcomes in the tails of the distribution, so to speak. And the point there is that this my policy is not necessarily optimal under this more general consequence. But the interesting implication of that kind of work is precisely what you were saying before. If what one is worried about is worst outcomes, then probably the right thing to do when you think there's a stock market bubble is to lower interest rates. Because you're thinking that there's some risk that there'll be a collapse and therefore a recession. And anticipation of that, given the lags, you ought to lower interest rates rather than raise interest rates, since you get exactly the opposite policy implication that that some have advocated. So more sophisticated thinking about this does in fact lead to some perhaps counterintuitive results about what the right policy response is. In the back there.
I'm just wondering if you considered your results in the context of a situation like Japan where you're, or in the US, where you're approaching the zero boundary for interest rates, what would be your sense, or can you, I know you can't measure it obviously for the US, but if you tried to extrapolate your conclusions and consider how valid they would be in that context?
Well, I mean, it's true that there the Lucas critique might apply because we haven't looked at the shocks in at very, very low interest rates, but we did look at them in recent periods where interest rates were pretty low, and we were not able to find any difference between the fairly low interest rate regime of the late 90s and early 2000s versus the higher interest rate regime of pre-94, for example. So we didn't find, you're thinking of nonlinearities that might occur for a given change in interest rates, we didn't find that to be very important. So at zero, I can't really say. But remember that the nonlinearity of the interest rate applies only to the permanent interest rate. The federal funds rate is a short-term rate, applies only to the very short-term changes in interest rates. It doesn't necessarily affect the long-term discount rate by very much. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that when interest rates are low that the effect will be larger. Where, here? Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. In there, Ms. Rowe?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Right. My name is Stephen Collins. I just had a question about your technique, really. You focused on unanticipated interest rate changes, but your conclusions seem to relate to interest rate changes in total. Now, presumably, anticipated interest rate changes do have an effect on the stock market. You just don't know when the anticipation is actual. Now, my question is, would it necessarily be the same size effect? Would the risk premium be the predominant effect where it's anticipated? Because one could expect that unanticipated would more likely affect risk outlook than anything anticipated. Or, so, first of all, do you think the size of the effect that you're deriving from the unanticipated could be carried over to the whole interest rate change? If you do you think that's because there's a substitution from risk premium effects to dividend or real interest rate expectations?
That's a very good question. The short answer is that just because of the nature of the problem, you know, this is true in a lot of monetary policy analysis, as you probably know, since we can't, you know, we can only observe the effects, we can only do event studies because of the efficiency of the stock market. We can't really do the counterfactual of asking, well, what happened if interest rates had been anticipatedly higher for a long period of time? So we can only rigorously answer the question by looking at the unanticipated shocks, and that's what we do. So then the question might arise specifically in the context of this question about bubble popping, for example. What about if we had a more systematic policy that leaned against the stock market, for example? And there I cite in my paper in the footnote some other research that I've done with Mark Gertler, which looks at that issue. There's two ways of thinking about this. One is that the Fed moves sporadically whenever it thinks it sees a bubble forming, in which case you would think that that its movements would be more or less unanticipated, and this analysis would apply. On the other hand, the other possibility is that you think about a policy in which the Fed systematically responds not to bubbles because we can't observe those, but responds systematically to movements in the stock market. So everything else equal, given expected inflation, given expected output, a rise in the stock market causes the Fed to raise interest rates systematically. Now, that policy has the problem, of course, that since you'll be leaning against not only bubbles, but you'll also be leaning against fundamental changes in stock values, and therefore be increasing, creating volatility in the economy that otherwise wouldn't be there. So there's sort of a trade-off. So in this other research, which I cite in the paper, several papers, Gertler and I did simulations looking at the effects of adding a stock market term, so to speak, to the policy rule, that having a response to the stock market over and above responding to inflation and output. And we found that generally that destabilized the economy and made outcomes worse. And again, the main problem is that in doing this, you can't, in general, it's very difficult to tell whether a stock market boom is fundamental or not fundamental. And by moving against fundamental movements, you're actually causing the economy to slow, to not take advantage of profitable investments, and therefore that's destabilizing to the economy. So that was, those are the results of separate work that we've done looking at this, looking at that approach. Can you hand the thing back here? Last question, okay.
I wondered if you thought with hindsight US monetary policy had made mistakes in the second half of the 1990s. And if so, what the key lessons to learn from that episode were?
It's just hindsight is just too easy a standard. I think that based on what people knew at the time that they knew it, I think that policy in the 90s was quite good, and a bit of evidence for that is the Bob Woodward book Maestro. Which talked about the exceptional policy of the late 90s and many other books that have talked about the late 90s. I think that policy in the late 90s was good. I wasn't there, so I don't have any inside information about it or any credit or debit as far as that's concerned. But I think based on what people knew at the time, I think policy was quite effective. We are now, I think, also now, I think, in a recovery period, and I think we'll see that that the recession that we've just faced, while not trivial, has been managed reasonably well, and that we'll be on a significant growth path the rest of this year and next year. So I think, again, that we have found a situation where policy has helped support a non-inflationary recovery that will be, I hope, and I believe to be, it will be sustainable over the next few years. Again, hindsight is just too easy a standard, and I think ex ante, I think the decisions were fairly insightful. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Ben. I should say that at the conclusion of the lecture, we'll be going up to the senior dining room where there is a reception, and you're all very welcome to join us. Let me also remind members of the press that if they wish to come and ask further questions, there's about 10 minutes worth of that can happen, so if you approach the front, the end. Finally, it just remains for me to thank Ben for his lecture and for coming all the way to present it to us. I think it really underlines the importance of the link between good research and policy making, and the value of having people like Ben who straddle academic life and policy life and cross-fertilize those two areas of endeavor. Thank you very much, Ben. We really appreciate it.